Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
Today we're going to talk about one of the greatest alchemists of all time. And this has kind of been a long time coming. His full name is, and pardon the pronunciation once again, but his full name is Abu Musa Jabir ibn Hayyan. He's also known as Al-Barighi. He's also known as Al-Azdi or Al-Kufi or Al-Tusi. Also as Al-Sufi, because he was a follower of the Sufist movements like Al-Ghazali. So if that all confused you, in the West, in medieval times and Renaissance and early modern times, he was just known as Geber. And a lot of times you'll hear a pseudo-Geber if you're researching alchemy. And so we'll kind of break that down a little bit. But in any case, Jabir, as we'll call him for the podcast, he lived from 721 to 815, and he was born in Tus, which is a Persian region, same as Al-Ghazali. So Persian, kind of today's Iran. And again, we have an example of a polymath. He was a chemist, alchemist, astronomer, astrologer, engineer, geographer, philosopher, physicist, pharmacist, physician, basically any field of science that they considered a field of science or philosophy, he dabbled in it in some ways. So he studied it and read up on it and became an expert in many fields along those lines and wrote a ton of books that we'll kind of talk about and get into.
And this kind of gives you an idea that Jabir is held in his highest esteem as being really the first practical alchemist. Born and educated in Tus, he later traveled to Kufa. He really set the movement in this. Can I say the gold standard? I think,
yeah,
excuse the pun, set the gold standard as the first practical alchemist. And this is very important because, at the least, this was his reputation that he was considered to be the first practical alchemist. It is argued what he actually wrote and what he didn't write. And as early as the 10th century, this was already in dispute. So let's add to this right now. In Christian Europe, his name was Latinized as Geber. And in the 13th century, an anonymous writer wrote alchemist texts under this name Geber, but is generally thought to be someone we would call pseudo-Geber. In other words, not the
right
guy.
That's what we call him today, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So we could definitely probably see through analysis of writing and time issues that this probably was not the same guy. Now, as we mentioned in the beginning, he's got many different names, and it's not because he's lost in the mists of history like some of our other alchemists that we mentioned on this podcast that we don't have a lot of background on, so we assume maybe this was four or five different people. Not necessarily. The reason why he has so many names is because that's where people would associate him from as far as his home village or hometown. So when we talk about Al-Azidi or Al-Barighi or Al-Kufi, he was talking about Kufa.
Yep.
You're right, the region of Kufa. Mm-hmm. Or talking about Al-Tusi. He was born in Tusi. Or Al-Sufi, depending upon his relationship to the Sufism movement.
Right. Yeah.
Right? So, it's confusing. Are you confused?
Yeah.
Are you still with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he's not necessarily lost in history. Makes it important for amateur historians and people that really want to follow alchemy that he stands clear as the genuine article.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's part of it is that he has this huge body of work, whether he wrote all of it or not, even just the parts that he definitely did write is enormous. I mean, it's a full life's work that he did. And his early life isn't known so well, so we've just said that he's from Tus, which would make him Persian. But there are some people believe that he's from Kufa, who lived in Khorasan, or a Persian from Khorasan, who later went to Kufa, or some think that he actually was Syrian originally and later lived in Persia and Iraq. So, it's not so important where he was born, but Yeah, that's where all the names come from. That's why there's some confusion.
Well, I would have to ask another question with this, Travis. You know, when we talked about Al-Ghazali in several podcasts ago, he's considered to be one of the forerunners of alchemy in the Middle East. Were these gentlemen actually peers at the time, or were they did they know each other, most likely?
Yeah, no, because Al-Ghazali was around 1000 to 1100. So, in fact, Al-Ghazali was in the time of Albertus Magnus and right before or around the same time as Thomas Aquinas. But as far as the Middle East goes, so they're possibly born in the same town, but yeah, a good 200 years apart. So if anything, Al-Ghazali built off of what Jabir already wrote down and kind of Al-Ghazali, you know, commented on Jabir's works and that kind of thing. Some of the things we do know is that, or that is more mainstream and accepted, let's say, is that he grew up in Yemen and he studied the Quran, mathematics, and other stuff. And it's in those years that he had a tutor that got him really interested in alchemy. So he started reading about this and that kind of became his passion. Okay, and then he went to go study medicine in Kufa, which is why he has Al-Kufi as one of his last names. And he was eventually put under house arrest after a regime change. So, you know, if you want to put it like that, so the prince that favored him died, and then a prince came to power that didn't like him so much. And so he eventually died in solitude. That's a long story short, but that's his biography in a nutshell, more or less. And I didn't want to go too in-depth into it because a lot of his life is a mystery, and there's a lot of speculation there. So I think what's more important for the show is kind of what he wrote down, like what are his works, right? In total, there's nearly 3,000 treatises and articles and what have you that are credited to Jabir. But in reality, like we already mentioned, that several of those were almost certainly not by him. So some possibly by his students or later Ismaili followers. And then again, we also have Pseudo-Gaber a good like 400 or 500 years later writing under his name.
Not really uncommon for an alchemist to impart his knowledge to students or you know, other tradesmen that studied under him. And as we talked about with a few other famous alchemists like Brahe, you know, probably would have a posse of people that would follow. And as much like in Brahe's case, that there was someone who would say, you know what, that was my idea. Mm-hmm. You know, after the death of their mentor.
So others might flesh out the theories and the philosophy, right. But did he really write everything? Almost certainly not. I mean, the texts really cover a huge range. We have cosmology, music, medicine, magic, biology, chemical technology, geometry, grammar, metaphysics, logic, artificial generation of living beings, which is awesome. It's like things like Gollum or that kind of thing. Astrological predictions, symbolic, imami myths. I mean, just all kinds of anything that he could think about and put to paper, he did.
The 112 books that are associated with him are dedicated to Barmakids, the viziers of Caliph Harun al-Rashid. This group includes Arabic versions of the Emerald Tablet. Now, Travis, you remember the Emerald Tablet? We talked about this in our podcast on Hermeticism. Yep. We talked about with Trismegistus. We talked about using the Emerald Tablet with several alchemists, including Isaac Newton's translation of it as well. So it does have some significance there as well. An ancient work that accrued to be valuable reoccurring foundation of a source of alchemy, alchemical properties and research. Right.
Yeah. So basically, the foundation throughout
maybe
the Middle Ages.
If you can try to associate this to maybe the Rosetta Stone. In a lot of ways that Napoleon found. So we can figure out hieroglyphics today. This is that same sort of sought-after information with the Emerald Tablet. In the Middle Ages, it was translated into Latin, Tabula Smaragdina, and widely diffused among European alchemists across the continent.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so very much used. The 70 books, most of which were translated into Latin during the Middle Ages, included Kitlab al-Zutla, which means the Book of Venus, and the Kitlab al-Ahira, which is the Book of Stones. The 10 books on rectification, containing descriptions of alchemists such as Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. We're talking all the big hitters here. So the 10 books, we're talking about these type of things, are very important because I would have to think, Travis, without him documenting this information or talking about philosophies or these type of things, it'd be lost to history.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that he – I mean, here's an example of the 10 books, but I think there's many old philosophical writings that he, quote, unquote, corrected. And some of those I would say that we wouldn't have today if he didn't get his hands on them and kind of do something with them.
Sure. So we can tip our hat to that, at least having that information. And one of the last set of books are the books on balance, which I think of more of a theory of a balance in nature. Again, mm-hmm. there are some of the alchemists that we've talked about in our podcast that focus a lot on the nature aspect of things, and some of it brought into a religious context as well. So he is one of those guys that I'm sure set the standard, and everybody else kind of followed or read up about him when they were making their treatises on alchemy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I mean, he was probably the basis for Al-Ghazali and then Albertus Magnus, Thomas Aquinas. I mean,
especially Albertus Magnus. Remember, he had a significant part in nature as far as
and got stuff directly from Arabic. Mm-hmm. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, sure. I'll mention one thing pertaining to his life is that Jabir had a somewhat famous or known teacher at the time. And it's not really that important who he was, but I'll mention him because his name was Jafar, and Jafar is the villain in Aladdin.
I was thinking you weren't going to go that direction, but you did.
His full name was Jafar al-Sadiq.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, that just happened.
Because he was a bad guy in those movies.
Yeah. Well, there you have it.
I don't think our listeners really appreciate it.
Maybe that's where he – I wonder which Jafar is he based off of. I don't know. But so the Shia consider him the sixth imam. So like a descendant of Ali, the son-in-law of Muhammad. I don't know how familiar our listeners are with Islam, but so a very, very important person. And Jabir actually spoke very highly of him and was regarded as a wise man in his own right. So kind of interesting connection there, right, with the sixth imam. Well, I should say the Shia imam. His other influences were, by influence I mean he mentions them in his writings. I don't know how influential they really were, but he mentions Egyptian and Greek alchemists, Zosimos, who we talked about, Democritus, who we'll talk about, who I think I already wrote the outline for him, Hermes Trismegistus, which, you know, Emerald Tablet, you mentioned that, Agathodaimon, which we've done a podcast on him too, and so we've covered them all, or we'll cover Democritus shortly. And so he's written about all of these and kind of incorporated them and really took all these sources and built the foundation of alchemy. After Jabir, there was nobody that worked alchemical stuff in a vacuum. Everybody related their work to Jabir in some way or other.
Well, I would probably call him an alchemic bridge builder in a lot of ways, because he's taking from different areas of the known world. Now, keep in mind, this area of Iraq and Iran was a hotbed of just great information going on at the time. I mean, it was a learned community, communities plural.
Oh, yeah.
And he was there.
Yeah.
So he helped set that. But he also took a little bit from the Greco era. The Greco era, we're talking about Plato and Aristotle and Pythagoras and Socrates, and bridged that gap there. So I think if you were an alchemist, an aspiring alchemist 200-300 years later, as we're getting into the Middle Ages, you would say, I want one source to kind of follow what's going on. I'd go to this guy, Geber.
Yeah. I mean, just for... just to complete the list, I mean, so we get all the influences. I read that he also wrote on Galen, Alexander of Aphrodisias, Simplicius, if I'm not butchering that, Porphyry. These are all kind of known philosophers and thinkers of their time. So, really interesting. I mean, he kind of combined everything and built his own theories together. Let's talk about this creation of life thing. I know that that's kind of an interesting one. So it's called Taquin. So what does that mean?
It is basically the creation of life. I mean, if you put it in a nutshell, there you go. It's a synthetic life in a laboratory. We don't know exactly what Jabir was meant by this, but we want to go ahead and assume that he meant like breathing life into the golem or Frankenstein from Mary Shelley.
Yeah,
right?
Kind of
you
thing.
Know exactly.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Bringing something from life to from lifelessness to life. Of course, that would be pretty awesome for all kings involved. And
let's go with that theory, because that's an awesome theory. We really don't know exactly.
No.
But I'm going to go with Frankenstein. That's what I'm going to go with.
Right. You know, you ever read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein? It's actually not probably what most people see when they see the old movies in the United States, those black and white movies or anything that came later. It's actually a pretty interesting sort of take on the philosophical reasons of why we leave things dead and we don't bring them back to life, right? Yeah. Right, because there's repercussions for that, and of course it crosses a lot of boundaries. But you know, this is the stuff that would really excite somebody to be a financier, maybe, mm-hmm. of an alchemist, saying, "Wow, you actually have the powers to bring back something that's dead to life."
Yeah, that's the ultimate medicine,
right? I mean, I want the Lazarus effect here. Yeah. Tell me how to do this, right? So you know, again, one of the reasons we don't know exactly what he meant is because that was the intent, to be somewhat cryptic. From the Book of Stones in 4:12, that quote unquote, "the purpose is to baffle and lead into error everyone except those who God loves and provides for," unquote.
So there's that esoteric, you know, writing in code again, and we've seen this many, many times.
Because we
see the same thing in the Christian world, if I can say it like that, that there's a possibility, and that if you wrote more clearly, you could probably get in trouble with the church. So it could be that if he wrote everything black and white, that he could have gotten in trouble with the Islamic leaders of the time. That's probably a safe assumption to make. I mean,
I would think so.
Yeah, another interesting thing that he wrote about and kind of developed as a system is a numerological system. So his alchemical investigations were theoretically grounded in an elaborate kind of numerology. And this, again, takes us back to Pythagoras, or kind of even like a Neoplatonic system. And so he said that, you know, elements, you know, back in the Aristotelian kind of view of elements, like the four elements, is that the nature and properties of these are defined through numeric values. And in Arabic, he assigns these Arabic consonants present in their name, as they would be called in Arabic. And ultimately, he came up with the number 17. Okay? So, for some reason, I don't know, but if you take the elements and you kind of break them down how they sound in Arabic, you come up with 17. Take it or leave it. I don't know what that means. But, you know, he's also a great example of a Neoplatonist. You know, he wouldn't have called himself that. Just like all Neoplatonists, he would have just viewed his, or, you know, believed that he kind of fell in line with Aristotle or Plato. But, again, it was, you know, it had this occult, like this mysticism attached to it that is, and this even religious aspect of the one and all these things that come back to Neoplatonism, which, you know, if you want us to break that down for you, we did an episode on that a while back, so just look up Neoplatonism and you'll find it. Some of these beliefs were kind of that he believed in spirits, which vaporize on heating, like, which, you know, tied to alchemy, it's like arsenic or realgar, orpiment, camphor, mercury, sulfur, sal, ammoniac, ammonium chloride. So these are like, they're spirits because they vaporize as you heat them up, right? And then he wrote about metals, you know, gold, silver, lead, tin, copper, iron, and carcini, which is an alloy, I assume. And then non-malleable substances that can be converted into powders, such as stones. So he kind of, again, he took all the things in nature around him and categorized them, you know, broke them down into some kind of system. And fortunately, at this time and place, a lot of the work that is related to that is still mostly in Arabic. So if we have any really enthusiastic Arabic-speaking listeners out there, well, you know, get to work. Let's
you know, and I think, you know, I'm sure it's been done before by other historians, but when you translate something from its original text to something else, there is some percentage that gets lost in translation. And I think you see this in several religious sort of concepts too. You know, we talk about who really believes in the
especially
Bible.
Especially if it's tied to philosophy or religion or something.
Exactly. Yeah. You get into that, it's like, well, you only follow what's the original Greek, you know, or Aramaic or Greek. And then you say, okay, we would translate it to something else. It loses something. The King James Version loses something from its original Greek. People will debate that till the cows come home. But yeah, there are some things that might be lost in that. But, you know, Travis, we kind of dive into what we said at the top of the podcast here, that that he was actually a practical alchemist.
Maybe the first, the way that
the
we
first. So he's going to put his money where his mouth is. He's mm-hmm. actually going to get in there and start making things happen with what he knows about these elements. I think to most of our listeners, you know, and everyone has probably their favorite alchemists, and then there's also the ones that they probably don't want to talk about. I think of Edward Kelly is a guy that's. I have a hard time calling him an alchemist, more of a charlatan.
I think he's many favorites. Though,
exactly,
because he's so colorful.
Exactly, but I think you have to put Geber in this own category here, because you know he could believe that he could turn base metals into gold and set that standard for everybody else to follow.
But I think that's what the listeners are.
That's what they want.
A lot of listeners are here for that. So
when they look at the podcast, I assume they say,
Job
"Oh, alchemy! I want to know how things are made into gold." Right. Well, then Geber is for you. All right, Jabir or Geber, as we like to be calling back and forth here on the podcast tonight, was all about experimentation. He would credit with some about 20 basic types of lab equipment, alembic and alchemical still, which I think a lot of our listeners probably have seen at some point in chemistry class. Right, he's got two tubs and a tube going between them. All right, mm-hmm. to take from one substance to the other. There's a retort, which is a sort of a ball with a cone at the top of it pointing downwards. You might have seen some of these in old medieval sketches. It sort of looks like a bird beak, you know, going down. All right. In addition, he's described many things that would deal with crystallization, distillation, taking things of citric acid from lemons, acetic acid from vinegar, arsenic. Travis, what are some other ones?
Tartaric acid from winemaking residues, antimony, which is a metalloid element, and that gets mentioned a lot in alchemy, by the way, antimony, bismuth, which is a kind of flaky, powdery metal.
Worthless.
Yeah. well, good in alloys, I guess. Others, you know, our favorites, sulfur and mercury, he wrote a lot about them. He wrote about the idea of chemical compounds, which is really interesting, like the mineral cinnabar being a compound of sulfur and mercury. Okay, so that, you know, that took a leap of faith, a leap of understanding to kind of write about those kind of things. Nitric and sulfuric acids, separation of gold from other metals using lead and saltpeter. So actually the methods of separation, the purification of mercury, and then he was responsible or partly responsible for introducing the word alkali for substances such as lye and other bases, right? So like the opposite of acids. So that was him. And then we have our famous aqua regia, which in the very first episode, and I think elsewhere, we mentioned them dissolving a Nobel Gold Prize so the Nazis couldn't find it, right? So he described this, like the acid that could dissolve gold, right? Like the royal water, basically. Supposedly, takes with a grain of salt. He invented a paper that was fire resistant and an ink that could be read at night and a material that made iron rust resistant and when applied to textile made it water resistant. So this is all definitely possible. We just don't know if he actually did it or not. And if he did, why isn't it still around today or known? But who knows? I mean, it's certainly possible. But when he's speaking of other arguments against alchemy, and I have this from the Alchemy Reader, which I've quoted before. He says, "This science, they say, hath been so long sought by wise men that if it were possible in any way, they would 1,000 times before now have been masters of it." So this is what he's quoting other alchemists of saying. And he's just kind of, he goes beyond that and says, well, you know, you just because you don't know how it works doesn't mean it's not possible.
An optimist.
Yeah, sure.
So we talk about the influence of Europe, Travis. I think that many things were given to Europe from the Middle East. And we're talking about the mathematics. We're talking about some of the science that was founded in these, as we mentioned, learned communities. His works were translated into Latin as early as the 12th century and became a standard in alchemist books.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he's the guy you got to go to. The Pseudo-Geber. Even published under his name and probably stole his identity for the sense that he wanted that acclaim, right, mm-hmm. because he was so well sought after. We still say alkali today. You know, we talk about alkaline batteries. We talk about, you know, alkaline desert, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We use that word quite a bit. Gibberish, is thought maybe to be derived from his name. We talked about Geber. Mm-hmm. It was a kind of a the what most Western Europeans used for his name, but gibberish would be something about poking fun at alchemists. Hey, you're talking gibberish. You're talking nonsense. This is this is not real.
If you read any medieval alchemist text, that's what you're reading. You're reading gibberish. I mean, it's
Talk about the angel language. Who wrote the angel language?
That was Edward Kelly.
Edward Kelly, right?
Or John Dee, rather.
Yeah, John Dee. That's right, John Dee. So that would probably be considered gibberish to a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. So, but there was something known as the Geber problem. What is that, Travis?
So how do you know which ones were Geber and which ones were pseudo-Geber, okay? So this was pretty difficult. I mean, it was just – it wasn't really until the 19th century – when people actually noticed a difference in styles, that some were – because until then, they just thought that all of the things we had in the West were Latin translation of Jabir's.
But then, the original.
Yeah. But then in the 19th century, they realized that there was a lot more Latin text than there were Arabic ones, and possibly some different styles. So to give some examples of what pseudo-Geber clearly wrote – or at least we assume, because there's no Arabic original, but the sum of perfection, the investigation of perfection, the invention of verity, the book of furnaces, the testament. So these are all under someone named, written by someone named Geber, but there's no Arabic known. And some people think that these could have been written under Moorish Spain, but again, like 400 to 500 years later. So they all, you know, again, we mention them together, because whenever they were written, they were assumed to be written by Geber, and they were all taken in as his, you know, corpus that he wrote, and they were
his
all built upon.
His body of work.
Exactly. Right. So they were all used as an influence for later alchemists. So, you know, it's hard to say if you pick an alchemist from the 16th century, and if he says one of my influences was Jabir or Geber, and, you know, they quote him, they might be quoting some guy speaking Latin 500 years later. It doesn't matter. The influence is still there. Both of them were you know, clearly had an influence on later thinkers. So just talk about pseudo-Geber for a minute. So, again, he wrote his name as Geber in Latin, and so it was heavily influenced by Arabic books written by Jabir, but and also influenced by Al-Razi, who we might do a podcast on. There's no Arabic original, and they're, you know, just stylistically, and or at least, you know, they didn't pop up before around 1310. You know, there's more. There's a Summa Perfectionis Magisteri, the height of the perfection of mastery. There's Book of Stills, which is actually a very famous one, the Liber Fornacum. There's On the Investigation of Perfection. You know, I've mentioned some others, On the Discovery of Truth.
So, the Inventions Veritas.
Yeah.
Discovery of Truth.
Yeah.
Right?
And then, like, the Testament is, you know, they'll even call it, like, Testamentum Gerberi, like the Testament according
to. Named after him. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to say. And some of these also quoted actual Jabir works. So it's really hard to kind of split exactly which one came from which. And just because you don't have an Arabic original doesn't mean it didn't exist at some point and just wasn't lost. So it's really hard to pick those apart in some cases. But anyways, when we talk about the influence and the reputation, again, we usually end these podcasts with, you know, him in popular culture. And again, it would be impossible in popular culture today to split pseudo-Geber from Geber. I mean, the name is once again larger than life. Right, so you know, why don't you give us some examples on?
Well, we're going to talk about his relation to modern and popular culture, from comic books to movies. He's mentioned everywhere. Geber is mentioned in Paulo Coelho's 1993 bestseller, The Alchemist.
Have you read that?
I haven't. I know that it exists.
I've read it.
It's pretty cool. Is it good?
Oh, yeah, it's good. It's
okay.
Really good.
Geber is also said to be the creator of the fictional mystical chess set in Catherine Neville's novels, The Eight and the Fire.
Mm-hmm.
All right. In S.H.I.E.L.D., Geber appears in the 8th century leader of an organization. Geber is also mentioned in the American sitcom Big Bang Theory in the episode The Guitarist Amplification. Mm-hmm. That's a
there
nice one.
Go.
That's a funny
yeah.
one. Geber Ibn Hayden is also mentioned in the graphic novel Habibi by Craig Thompson. Mm-hmm. All right, and then also in the DC comic book title Demon Knights. Now, I have heard of that. The 11th century engineer Al-Jabbar appears to be based on Jaber Ibn Hagen. So, yeah, I mean, it is picked up in several places as maybe not in a historical sense, maybe in The Alchemist a little bit, but in the rest of them, the life is bigger than maybe the historical context.
Sure.
Right? Yep. Folk hero status.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely, the name lives on, so there you have it. That's all we have today, so thanks for listening.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter @AlchemyPodcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.